You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue on a awesome day of radio here on All Marine Radio. And joining me from Texas, Michael Musselman. What's going on, man? Oh, he's not there. Stand by. I hate that. And here he is, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Michael Musselman.
Are you there?
I am here.
I had a break in the contact there for a second. Don't know if it's the weather.
Is it? Why? What's wrong with the weather?
Oh, it's like pouring out. It's freaking cold.
That's been California weather, man. It's like they picked us up and dropped us in Illinois or someplace.
Like, yeah. No, it's true. Hey, I got a fact for you real quick.
Uh-oh. All right, go.
This is pretty interesting.
All right.
Today, in 2019,
yes,
we are farther away from the outbreak of World War II than the outbreak of World War II was from the American Civil War. Isn't that crazy?
We are farther away from World War II
than the outbreak of World War II was from the American Civil War.
35 and 45 makes 80?
No, so 39. The outbreak of World War II is 1939. You know, the Germans invaded Poland.
Oh, it's pretty close, though.
So it's, 1863.
World War II doesn't start for our clock if we're going to compare it to the Civil War.
I didn't say the U.S. involvement. I said the outbreak of World War II.
Hey. But you compare it to the Civil War.
The outbreak?
No. All right. All right.
Well, I'm just doing that as a comparison. Yeah, but that shows you time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, 74 years ago today. Fourth and Fifth Division go ashore at Iwo Jima.
I want to clear something up.
Yeah.
For the longest time, I was told something wrong about World War II, and I had to pull it up. So I've been looking it up, and I have this, my World War II, the Encyclopedia of Facts and Figures by John Ellis.
Whoa.
And it's like a catalog. This thing is, if you're a World War II buff, you have to own one of these because everything's in here. Everything.
All right.
Okay. So the largest amphibious invasion was?
Normandy.
Wrong. I thought the same thing.
Hold on. The invasion of the Philippines.
Okinawa.
Oh. Oh, really?
40,000 American troops, Army and Navy, Marines, landed in Okinawa on the first day of the invasion, compared to 4,000 U.S. and British and Canadian troops on Normandy.
34,000?
24.
Whoa,
on the first day.
Little guy invasion.
Yeah. So I want to clear that up. Now, they may have more ships.
And ultimately, more people went ashore there. But
ultimately, yes. But on the
day
we're
one,
talking about amphibious invasion,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okinawa was the largest. So, in your eye.
The door-kicking event, 40 grand?
40 grand, brother.
Wow. Wow. And Okinawa, man, if you want to read some serious shit, man.
So, I was so pissed.
Why?
I believed what you said for Normandy. So long.
Normandy. Well, you know what you hear? What organization has conducted the most amphibious operations on the planet?
The most? Yes. The most. Yes. That is true fact. But the largest is still the Marine Corps. Mmm. In your face.
We'll find a statistic that makes us look good. And what are we going to do with that? We blow that son of a bitch up.
We're going to, like ashes in our hand, we're going to blow it right in your eyes and kick you in the nuts.
And then we're going to manufacture a bunch more ashes and we're going to blow that in everybody's face. Okay?
Yep. Here's another fact.
Yes. Whoa, here we go.
two U.S. carriers were stationed in the Great Lakes near Michigan during World War II, used to train Navy pilots to land on moving carriers. Those carriers were hidden in such secrecy that most people never knew their existence until after the war. One of them was the USS Wolverine.
That's how we tricked those Michigan losers into taking the thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah, they're so easy. We'll name it after one of your football teams. But that alienated half the state, the people that are Michigan State Spartan fans.
I know.
Yeah. They would have said, I'm not landing on that sumbitch. Ditch it in the water.
Yeah. Here's another fact.
I'll go down in my plane and look for the Edmund Fitzgerald.
In 1941, the U.S. military was smaller than the Romanian army.
That's crazy. Romania had bigger threats than the United States did. We'd come home, right? We stood everybody down, sent them home, and shrunk back into our pre-World War One configuration, which is, you know, garrisoning the frontier and the border with Mexico.
Yeah. And so here's another thing. I didn't know this. So we always believed that chemical warfare was never employed in World War II.
Let me give that some thought. Well, how do you define a chemical?
Well, any, like mustard, you know, any nerve agents or blistering agents, choking agents.
Yes, if that's how you define it, I would say my understanding is that I don't know of an incident during World War II where mustard or nerve
manufactured chemical.
Well, manufactured chemical, does that include CS? Tear gas?
No, I would say I wouldn't put that in there. Capsulin, yeah, that was always used.
So CS but, not included.
Yeah, not included CS, because CS is, I would say, is more of a deterrent type thing, whereas deterrent. The other chemicals are designed to kill you.
It's a deterrent.
There's...
I don't feel that whenever I've been exposed to CS. And
no, I don't either.
I don't feel like, oh,
but
this is a deterrent.
Tell you, there was one incident of chemical warfare used in World War II.
Only one.
And you know who did it?
Hold on. Who would have done chemical warfare in, I would say the French.
Wrong.
Who?
Us.
Huh?
Yeah, I read this and I had to look this up too. The U.S. military brought canisters of mustard gas into the Italian port of Bari, just in case. That was just in case thing. So we landed it. We're landing in Italy. So in the town of Bari, right. B-A-R-I, we had mustard gas shells in ships, and the Luftwaffe bombed those ships, letting loose that mustard, which killed, we don't know today, how many military and civilians. In the town of Bari, and we never talked about it.
Why would we have taken mustard gas?
I don't know. Crazy.
Who decided that was on the list of munitions? HE, got it. HEDP, got it. Got it.
7.62,
got it.
Mustard gas.
Got it. What? Wait a minute.
It's already packed in shrink wrap? Ah, shit. It's already in the forklift? Okay, just put it in the hole. We'll do it when we get over there.
Yeah, who said, wait a minute, we're not taking
it. But then the Luftwaffe bombed us, and so, of course, you know, hey, if they had never bombed us, then that would have never happened. Well, no, it's freaking war, idiots. That's what happens.
Yeah,
but yeah, we're the only country to use, inadvertently, I mean, we didn't use it on purpose, but it doesn't matter. That doesn't make it any better.
Was it part of the, was it present in most of the theaters, Mike, as kind of the loadout? Because it's not like the captain of that ship says, yeah, look, I got everything here. Somebody go find some mustard gas. I mean, that's not how that worked. I mean, was it part of the basic loadout for the...
No, I think they brought it as a just in case because some intel weenie told somebody that the Germans were more than likely to use some kind of weapons. You know, they hadn't used them at all.
Yeah, so all of a sudden they're going to use them in Italy, so at Bari, so let's take some.
Yeah.
I'd be so pissed.
Yeah, so chemical incident in Bari, which is like, I was, once again, I was like, oof, man.
Yeah, you know, World War II, on the grand scale, was not very well supervised, right?
No, it wasn't. Yeah, like people think it was.
Oh, no, we went from tiny army, right, tiny military, to gigantor military, and not, I mean, like that, you know.
Like in a year.
Yeah, if you've seen the movie Dirty Dozen, the character that Don Rickles plays, what's his name, Crap Game, he's got this whole, like, black market thing going on. And, I mean, I don't think that's very far-fetched. I think that, I mean, you know, people started doing it what they did, and you got all this material, all these people moving, and, I think that stuff doesn't surprise me, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very close. Yeah, so you went from less than 500,000 in the entire U.S. military, all branches, and within a year... We were, you know, four million. I mean, that's just absolutely absurd. I mean, there were training camps all over. I mean, that's why you had the USS Wolverine floating in Lake Michigan.
Yeah, no kidding. The USS Harvey, the USS John Harvey, was the U.S. World War II Liberty ship. The ship was most well known for carrying a secret cargo of mustard gas and whose sinking... by German aircraft in December of 1943 at the port of Bari in South Italy caused an unintentional release of chemical weapons. The Harvey was built in Wilmington, North Carolina, and launched on 9 January 1943. Her maritime commission hull number was 878. She was rated as capable of carrying 504 soldiers. She was sunk in December. She did not even live a year. Roosevelt approved the shipment of chemical munitions containing mustard gas to the Mediterranean theater on November.
Let's pass the buck on the dead guy.
Well, what else do we do? Sailed so. But
you've
why?
Never heard of that either, huh? I was like shocked.
I don't. After stopping for an inspection by the officer of the 7th Chemical Ordnance Company. At Augusta, Sicily, on 26 November, the John Harvey sailed through the Strait of Ontario at Bari.
Yeah. Crazy shit, man.
Bari was
packed, I never knew that.
Bari was packed with ships waiting to be unloaded, and the John Harvey had to wait for several days. Captain Knowles wanted to tell the British port commander about his deadly cargo and requested it be unloaded as soon as possible, but secrecy prevented him from doing so. So, I don't know. So
you would think that someone would say, hey, unload that one shirt first. You know, well, I'm the harbor master here, and I choose what gets off. Okay, you're fired. You're not the harbor master. That ship goes first. Yes, sir. Okay, you're staying on.
All right. A total of 628 military victims were hospitalized with mustard gas symptoms, and by the end of the month, 83 of them had died. The number of civilian casualties, thought to have been even greater, could not be accurately gauged since most had left the city to seek shelter with relatives. Details of the attack were given in a 1967 article in the U.S. Navy Journal Proceedings and a 1976 book by Glenn Infield entitled Disaster at Bari.
But I never heard of it.
Well, now we're going to have to deep dive into it to find out why we, as a nation, were taking mustard gas to Europe.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't get it. Here's another crazy fact, man. I'm full of factoids today because I was watching something last night.
What were you watching?
Oh, just some things on World War II that were kind of, you know, just, but it was spinning in my head. I was like, So then I looked into, okay, so in 1939, Finland was attacked by the Russians, okay?
Right.
So when you look at Finland, Russia is 41 times greater than the population of Finland overall. But during the war with Finland and the Russians had lost 1 million troops compared to Finland's 70,000.
What?
The Russians lost 1 million troops.
In Finland?
in the battle for Finland.
How?
All the battles. When you look at, okay, so let me pull, like, all, because they attacked in the wintertime, of course. Not very smart, especially when the Finland puts dynamite in the lakes when their tanks go rolling across. Right. Yeah. But the battle took place.
Oh. Hold on. I'm reading about the John Harvey. The crew of the John Harvey didn't know that they had chemical munitions. The only people that knew was a seven person logistics detachment that was told. 75-man? Yeah. 75 years later, the Bari disaster raised certain questions. The stated U.S. policy at the time was not to use chemical weapons unless the Axis nations used them first. Then why did the U.S. bring chemical weapons to the war zone in Italy? An unconvincing answer would be to contend that the U.S. wanted to be ready for immediate retaliation. However, even in 1943, adequate logistical arrangements were made to shift a certain amount of highly specialized chemical weapons at short notice from mainland America on priority. This is clearly brought out in the final report of the Army Special Forces entitled Logistics in World War II, submitted to the Undersecretary of War by the Director of the Service Supply and Procurement Division, War Department, General Staff, under the aegis of Center for Military History, United States Army, 1993. Was the consignment of chemical weapons on board the USS John Harvey the first or only one of many to land in Europe? Would the U.S. have used chemical weapons had they not been destroyed in the Bari raid? Answers to these hypothetical questions are difficult to assess. Bringing chemical weapons to the war zone was most probably with the intent of using them in the retaliatory mode. However, the relatively low effectiveness of chemical weapons to help achieve military objectives would have been a key criteria in the final decision matrix. The decision of bringing such weapons into the battle zone needs to be taken only in case blah, blah, blah. So it doesn't say, doesn't get to the bottom of it. Doesn't get to the
interesting.
Bottom.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Interesting little question there. There's German reconnaissance photos of the ship, too, as it burned. And nobody knowing that mustard cloud going over the city of Bari and over other ships in the port. Right.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you.
All supervision, man.
Yeah. What this is testament to. This is how shitty chemical weapons work. Right. So you blow up a large quantity of them. Right. And of the 693 people that were affected by this stuff, only 85 get killed. 85 ultimately die, or 83 ultimately die.
Right.
So that's how hard chemical weapons are. To use, and they're just they're more for terror than they are for effectiveness, because it's hard to get.
Yeah, you can't control. A lot of that is just Mother Nature, man.
Yeah, lethal dose, you know, ground temperature, air temperature, wind direction.
Persistent, non-persistent.
Yeah,
all that shit.
Well, that's interesting. Interesting. There's a whole bunch of if you look up Bari, Italy, B-A-R-I, Italy, mustard gas, it's a whole series of articles about it. So, very interesting, my friend. Well done.
Yeah, like I said, I was looking up a lot of stuff, and then, you know, so I looked up, Hitler. Hitler killed 12 million people, 6 million of which were Jews. Stalin killed an estimated 25 million.
Yeah, Stalin taking a backseat to nobody.
Yeah, I mean, he's just
and how many?
You know what? You want to know something else that was crazy I found out about?
What?
You know, it was about Henry Ford. I was watching a little segment about Henry Ford. That guy was a crazy son of a bitch.
Of course he was. He was like the richest guy on the planet.
So
before,
in 1938 and 19. He actually financially backed the Nazi Party in the United States with several million dollars. Of course, in 1941 that check changed. But he was a very pro Nazi Party member here in the United States. But people don't talk about that, so that's why I don't buy Fords now. I'm not a Nazi.
You buy Chevy. Volkswagen.
Well, no, they were the people's car. That's different. But yeah, Henry Ford was a Nazi party supporter in the United States prior to 1941.
Joe Kennedy.
Nazi Party candidate.
Yeah, he, Joe Kennedy was, come on, those Germans, they're not that bad.
Well, they hushed that up. If you read about that, how, yeah, Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy family was very pro-Nazi Party, and then all of a sudden, war kicks off, he does his thing, then Kennedy starts running for office, it's up, and then...
Yeah, that happened. They feel that, like, Joe, you need to go home.
Yeah, the Kennedys, man, that's when you knew that there was some power in the Kennedy family back in those days. Because they're getting ramping up when both of them were just, the attorney general and running. Man, they were, let's shut these guys up.
All right, so now that we're talking about killers, I have two little pieces of data. And first of all, I want to talk to you about diseases in history. What disease, right, or sickness killed the most people in the history of the world?
Yeah. Wasn't the Black Plague.
Okay, I'm going to give you some choices. Cholera, AIDS, influenza, the Black Plague, smallpox, tuberculosis, or malaria. Number one is?
Influenza.
Malaria. Good guess, though.
Really?
Yeah. Malaria. Number two?
Influenza.
Tuberculosis. Number three?
Smallpox.
Smallpox, correct. Number four?
Ooh. I don't know.
Black Plague. Malaria. Black Plague. Influenza. But the numbers are this. Malaria. 1 billion plus. Tuberculosis, 1 billion.
And still going.
Yeah. Tuberculosis, second at 1 billion. Smallpox, 500 million. The plague, 240 million deaths attributed to plague. And so
there wasn't good record keepers back then.
But. Well, yeah, okay, so these are estimates, granted, very, very good. 1, 2, 3, those are the top four. So malaria is 1 billion plus, tuberculosis at 1 billion, right? Smallpox, 500 million, plague, 240 million. Then it goes down to the influenza, 50 million, cholera, 40 million, AIDS, 36 million. And so there you have it. So those are the greatest disease killers. Now, let's talk about the greatest dictators/murderers of all time. Who is number one? And you're not going to get this. I'm going to tell you right out of the chute. You will not get this. Yeah.
Number one.
Number one.
Napoleon.
This is Napoleon week. Survey says? No.
Well, you said.
Mao.
Critics. You know what? I thought of Mao.
You thought of Mao? Critics of Mao Zedong saw unprecedented losses of human life through inhuman economic policies such as the Great Leap Forward, slave labor throughout the empire, violent political purges such as the Cultural Revolution, and the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries, and class extermination through land reform. Minimum death toll is the minimum estimate of famine dead, 15 million. Minimum estimate of land reform dead is 1 million, plus minimum estimate of counter-revolutionaries dead, 712,000, plus minimum number estimated for the Cultural Revolution dead, 400,000. Death toll estimates at the high end, 70 million people.
And wow. I was going to say, too, and I was thinking about it because, the top five, Mao, Stalin, Hitler, Leopold and Toad, what's the guy from, what was his name? Tojo?
Yeah, there's.
They don't know how many people he killed in China during the occupation.
Right.
In Manchuria.
Stalin estimates of Stalin on the low end 3 million. Nobody believes that. On the high end,
no.
60 million people between his purges and their policies that were designed to exterminate people. The Nazi Holocaust estimate is that
low end. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't have low end one. It just says best estimate, 17 million people killed in their purges as well as their extermination camps. This is number four, killings under the Chinese Nationalist Government, 1928 to 1946. Estimates, let's see, 440,000 to a million Chinese civilians perishing in a man-made flood made by Chinese nationalists to stop a Japanese advance.
What about Leopold II?
Hold
that
on.
That guy is
4.2 million Chinese perishing before entering combat due to starvation, death, or dying from disease. 1.7 to 2.5 million Chinese starving to death due to grain being confiscated and sold to other peasants for profits by government officials. And 1 million Chinese starved or killed in order to fend off communist advance. So the Chinese, I mean, they blew up dams and killed like a million people. So that was the Chinese government against its own people during the World War II. And then they entitled this the Japanese War Holocaust, 1895 to 1945. Japanese had no issues. Leopold, what are you talking about? Who's Leopold? Khmer Rouge? Young Turks? North Koreans.
Leopold II of Belgium of the Congo, the rubber. Oh, dude, I read a book about that. That's the greatest cover-up in modern
atrocities
history.
Atrocities under Rana Valona of Madagascar? Is that?
No, Leopold II of Belgium, King Leopold.
Congo Free State horrors. That guy?
Yep, that's it. That's that guy.
Private forces under control of King of Leopold II of Belgium carried out mass murders, mutilations, and other crimes.
God.
Against the Congolese in order to encourage the gathering of valuable raw materials, principally rubber, right?
The rubber exploitation, man, that thing was – you read about that. There's a lot of books. It's a beautiful book.
Estimates of the death toll varied considerably because of the lack of formal census before 1924. But a commonly cited figure of 10 million deaths was obtained by estimating a 50% decline in the total population during the Congo Free State and applying it to the total population of 10 million in 1924. Yikes, man.
Yeah, that's something that went unnoticed, too. Kind of, it's still not talked about. You know, Belgium, you know, has one of the top five mass murder dictators in their lineage.
The one in Cambodia between 70 and 79?
The Khmer Rouge?
Yes, 1.5 to 3 million people, and that was like recently. You know, dictators suck, man. You know, if you, the whole world
Kim
should
Kim Il-sung, right?
Yeah, if you're a dictator, we're not good with it, and we're going to take you down. Because all they do is they start too much shit around the world.
See, in the free state of Muslim world, when I became like king, I don't like the name dictator. If I became king, because I would, it'd be a monarchy.
I would have to take it down. Yeah.
Then you're gonna force me to like be a bad guy. You're threatening me.
No, you can't. It doesn't matter. You can't be a king.
I'm a good guy. I'm going to make
great matter.
Decisions.
No monarchies.
Well, I'm not saying it's a monarchy.
Yes,
I'm
you are.
Saying,
you just said it was a monarchy.
Can, well, no, I'm using that word so you have a relative understanding of what that means.
Oh, trust me.
It
I know.
Look, smell and act like one, but it wouldn't be one. It would be a democracy-free state.
But what does that mean, a democracy-free state?
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I would just, as much as, and see, I talk about.
You're free to state whatever you want. That's what the free state means.
See, I talk about the fictitious nation of McNamara, where I am the benevolent king of that.
Muscleandia? McNamara?
Yeah, we could go to the UN. And everybody would be happy. Everybody would be happy because there would be, you know, people that lived well and economic opportunities.
No one would want. There would be no,
No, you get the help that you need from a benevolent country that does the right things. I'm with you.
Yeah. Everybody would be, there would be no mansions. There would be no, you know, because again, everything would be equal. Equal. And I know people would be like, no, you know, I want to make more money. I want a bigger house. It'd be like, oh, you're going to the island. What's
well,
the island?
You
great vacation.
You can make Manny Machado signs with the Padres for $300 million.
See, that's insane. In 10 years, it's going to be $600 million.
Why, you know, would you want to go, why would you want to go play with the Padres, though?
At what point, what sport is going to break the $1 billion? Make a forecast. Look in the years out. The
for contract? Well, let me just tell you, I don't
what
think
sport
you would
will break a billion.
Well, what sport?
And don't say you don't think soccer. It'll ever happen. Because
football.
In 1952, if we would have said baseball is going to pay a player $100 million to play baseball, you know what they would have done to you?
Come on.
Yeah. Quit drinking, Mac.
Yeah.
What are you drinking now? What bottle are you hitting?
What are you hitting on? The You got your vaping? What are you doing?
What sport break a billion?
Yeah, I just don't, like, okay. So.
Well, you think billion is a silly number?
Well, if you do the math, so what are the highest contracts in highest?
I mean, we're a third of the way there. 300
in professional sports. Yeah, but aren't there soccer players getting that's?
Soccer players make European soccer players. I think are the most paid, but also they're taking in endorsements.
Should we not count that? So are you? How are we defining how much
just
you get paid? $1 billion. All right. Here are the world's top 10 highest paid athletes by contract. Number one, Canelo Alvarez, boxer. Signed 11 fight contract with London-based video streaming service, according to The Guardian, getting paid $365 million over the course of the contract. So that's 10 fights, so 10 years. He's making about the same as Manny Machado. And number two, Giancarlo Stanton, $325 million for 13 years. So what is that a year? 325 by 13, Mike. Put your math guy, come on.
What? I was reading something. What?
325 divided by 13 equals 25 million a year. Alex Rodriguez was 275 million for 10 years, so 27 million. Alex Rodriguez again, Miguel Cabrera, 248 million. So the highest paid athletes in basketball, James Harden, $228 million, for 6 years. That's pretty expensive. So 228 divided by six? Yeah. Holy smokes. James Harden, he's making $38 million a year.
Wow.
Yeah, see, here's the deal, though. Here's what I don't understand about Manny Machado. Okay, once, I want to make this much money. Okay, so bottom line is we're a long way away from a $1 billion. Now, over the course of a lifetime of the contract, maybe you could get there. But the trend in baseball, anyway, is the bigger teams are not like the Red Sox and the Yankees, who historically have bid prices up, said, look, this is what we'll do. 10-year contracts, they're losers, even if these guys are in their prime, right? and they wouldn't go further than I read, and I don't know if it's true, but, you know, 8 years is as far as we'll go. Both guys are 25, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado. So 8 years would make them 33, still very much in the prime of their careers, but by the way statistics look, not worth the money. And so, but here's my question. So if you're the player and I'm the agent and I say, okay, look, Mike, the Padres are offering $10 million, right, or $300 million for 10 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you can go to them. Let's see, the Dodgers are offering, you know, $250 million for 8 years. The Yankees are offering $240 million for 8 years, and the Red Sox are offering $245 million for 8 years. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Where do you want to live? Where do you want to go be a gazillionaire? Do I want to go to San Diego and never play in the playoffs? Because
yeah.
San Diego doesn't have the financial base. Once they give him that money, now what?
Yeah.
So look, you're going to have more money than you can ever conceive of spending. Your biggest problem is going to be trying to preserve it and not get it taxed away and taken from you. So, but you're still talking about you're going to have hundreds of millions of dollars to spend. What do you want your career to be about? Wasting away in San Diego? That's the part I don't get. I would take less money and I would go play in a place that was the center of the universe. And I would define that as places like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, where every day I'd kind of get fired up to go to work. I don't get this. Like, let's go play for a ton of money and never play in the playoffs. So, enjoy.
Yeah, but it's just insane. I mean, so when you're thinking of, like, you know what's the lowest paid? Hockey players.
The lowest paid minimum salary or the lowest paid highest athlete?
Well, the lowest paid minimum wage salary. Hockey players.
And then what is that, $600,000? Something like that?
NHL guys?
Yeah.
No, it's lower than that. Let me pull back up again. Well, we're not talking Europeans. We're keeping Europeans out of this. Because European soccer players, they skew the whole NHL.
These are rookie minimum salaries for each league. The NFL, $435,000. Major League Baseball is $507,000. The NBA is, they have this, the league minimum is $543,000. They don't even have the NHL in here?
No, because it's low.
They have the WNBA. Right? The minimum salary in the WNBA is $37,950.
Well, this says pro hockey players in the United States are a salary of $550,000.
Minimum.
Minimum.
Yeah, this says NHL, and then there's nothing underneath it. There's nothing.
Yeah,
there's nothing in it. So I thought it was $500,000. I thought it was close to it. That's pretty good coin, man. That's pretty good coin. You know.
For what they do, yeah, I guess so. I'd rather pay those guys. Well,
minimum,
I wouldn't pay either one of them.
Minimum professional sports salaries. This is the hockey. It says $650,000, which would make them the highest paid minimum. What?
That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. I didn't. But I know a kid who's playing in the NHL, and I know that he. That's why I said $600,000, because he grew up. You know, I coached him and played JV baseball for me, and playing for the LA Kings now. And my son said his average salary. I'm looking for minimum. And my son said, yeah, he's making over $600,000. I was like, holy shit, man!
And that's a year.
Yeah. Major League Baseball, 490. NFL, 405. NHL, 525. So
yeah,
it says the NHL is the highest minimum.
No, it's not.
The highest minimum salary is the NHL.
How can, no. Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
You know, Mike and I were talking about this once, but if you play one, if you're on a major league roster, you get health care for the rest of your life.
Yeah, you play a minimum of games.
Yeah.
Minimum.
No, that's not even a minimum. You play 37 games, you get a pension for the rest of your life. It's their minimum pension. But if you play, right, or if you're on a roster for 37 days, you get money for the rest of your life. And again, it's just being on the roster that gets you health care for the rest of your life. If you're on a major league roster during a regular season, you get health care for the rest of your life.
And people will say, well, that's not enough to live off. Yeah, it's like $10,000 a month.
No, not the minimum pension.
Not the minimum. Like,
no,
but the average pension that these guys get.
Yeah. Look, my dad is like, I want to say close to $20,000 a month. And that's the maximum you can make out of the pension plan. Yeah, he was in Major League Baseball starting in 1968, and I think he finally ended in 1994. 1995 was his last year. So he was over 20 years in Major League Baseball, and yeah, that's some serious. That is some serious jack every month, right?
So in 1964. Which was what, 50 or 55 years ago? The average salary in baseball was $85,000.
Right, that was big money too. I remember
when 55 years it goes from the average to that to which in equals today's dollars at $622,000 a year. That's a pretty steep. When you draw that out on a graph, Mac.
Yeah, what does it look like?
When you graph that out,
yes,
that's climbing Everest.
That's
a pretty steep incline. That's not walking across the Great Plains.
That's serious vertical.
It's going there. It's like a moonshot.
Email. First of all, Mac, unbelievable interview in the first hour. And then another unbelievable interview in the second hour. Well done today. You guys did a great interview with Bob Woodruff. Well done. The interview with Laura Logan is absolutely off the hook. Anybody who's listening to this hour, when the first hour comes back on, do not touch your dial because she is the truth. Yeah, I saw headlines about the interview yesterday, so last night I listened to it. The whole thing's 3.5 hours long, right? She'd born and raised in South Africa, you know, been in the, you know, working in the American media, blah, 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 blah. But look, when she tells you that, you know, that 85% of the American media are registered Democrats, and of the 15% that's left, 14% just were too lazy to register, but 99% of them are registered Democrats, and that skews the coverage, and anybody who can't admit to that is part of a lie, and that kind of skewed coverage isn't good, and that no longer are there standards for two sources. It is one anonymous source, blah, 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 and they go to print with that, which never used to be the standard. So let me tell you, it's absolutely fascinating, as are her comments about, you know, her thoughts on the war in Iraq, and not only the decision to go to war, but she absolutely hammers Barack Obama and his administration, who got no criticism for just leaving Iraq, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, right, which set up what ISIS moved into, blah, 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 blah. And it's an awesome, awesome interview. And so don't touch your dial. And then the interview.
You interviewed her?
No. She got interviewed by a SEAL who does a podcast. His name is Mike Ritland. And he's, I think his dog.
If you wanted to talk to her, I know Laura.
You do?
Yeah.
Get her on. Mike, listen to the first hour, or I'll send you an audio cut of it. It's about 40 minutes. It is awesome. Just not only her observations, but her take on the American media. All the stuff that we talk about and bitch about how the truth doesn't matter anymore, she hammers it. And then, you know, and she says, look, talking like this is professional suicide. And, I mean, she has some guts. I mean, the courage that she had to do that article, I mean, that interview, awesome. Awesome. So how do you know her?
Through another buddy of mine. So when it was like, God, almost 10 years ago when, Mubarak, she was covering the Mubarak thing where she was sexually assaulted in the square.
Right.
And, that's a horrible story. And
she talks about that in this interview.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I'm trying to think, let me make some phone calls.
Okay.
And then,
she's probably a little bit inundated these days because of the things she said. Because she's national news. There's every news outlet.
Yeah, she works for CBS.
She used to. She was on 60 Minutes. Yeah, so we're not talking about like, Mike McNamara and Mike Musselman are talking shit about the national media. You know, she's talking shit about the state of the American media, and she's one of the primaries was one of the primaries on 60 Minutes. Okay. That's big shit. Okay. But again, it's just refreshing to see somebody stand up and say, this is garbage. And she says, this is horse shit. Yeah. She's a baller, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she got four kids and I don't know what she's doing these days. But God bless her, man. God bless her. And because, again, we don't have enough people telling the truth. We do not have enough people telling the truth.
Yeah, I'd have to see a photograph of her because I think she's, like, completely different. You know, because I'm trying to think, when was the last time? She had blonde hair when I first knew of her.
Yeah, she's a dark-haired girl now.
I just recently saw something. I couldn't even recognize her. So yeah, let me do some phone call.
Yeah, and you know the Woodruff interview is you know just his whole story to me is really interesting. I mean, he leaves college, going to be a lawyer, and he's in Beijing, and the Tiananmen Square, you know, thing blows up, and he's on to a different life, and that life takes him and crosses paths with Mike. Were you guys first LAI battalion or first LAR? Had they changed it?
LAR. Yeah, we were LAR.
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 So, crosses paths with Mike and in the whole march up thing and all that stuff. And then, you know, then he's seriously wounded. And then the things he's gotten into and his wife have gotten into. I sent you a text, but you need to get Lee Woodruff on.
Well, I can't. That's up to Bob.
Well, call, text Bob and say, hey, Bob, we want Lee to come on. You were okay. We want Lee.
All right, I will.
Yeah. Because she is,
so, yeah,
she is huge.
Okay, so Joe, now it's all coming. Joe Burkett used to be in the Army. And that's Joe's the husband.
Of
Laura.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And now he's a doc. He's doing something with like psychiatry. No, not psychiatry, but like something like what we were talking about. That's PTSD stuff. But he was an army. He's an army enlisted guy.
Nice. Yeah, she's. I'll tell you what. The interview. The interview's 3.5 hours long. You think we do long interviews? Holy shit. 3.5 hours, and she talks about all kinds of stuff. She talks about being with Marines in Ramadi, hooking and jabbing with them. She talks about what happened to her in Egypt. That's where I first remember seeing.
Yeah, the Mubarak thing.
Yeah, the whole Mubarak thing. She talks about that. You know, she says something about, it's like somebody sticking a knife in you when she says it. She says, you know what they say in Iraq and Afghanistan? The only thing then having America. The only thing worse than having America as your enemy is having America as your friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. You're like, so true.
Let me get in touch, though, because Joe's a Texan, too, so.
Oh, you can slip him the grip.
Let me get in touch.
All right. But the other thing about Bob Woodruff is the work that their foundation does. And if you read about the foundation, one of the things he talked about his wife's experience as he was comatose, as she interacted with other people on that floor, and just different stories that all of a sudden your life takes this turn and what you're exposed to and the impact that it had on her. And now their support, the foundation support of caregivers, because you know, women all of a sudden, in the blink of an eye, for the rest of their life, they become caregivers, and that's not the easiest gig in the world. So
no, and then raising kids too. She had four kids to raise.
Right.
You know, and you know, not even to make it small, but she, you know, she was a very, very successful, if not still today, professional woman herself.
Right, right. And no, and right, and he said that. He said, you know, we were lucky, right? We had ABC standing behind us and the best care and people, you know, I mean, my story was not a secret, and ABC was going to do what was right by me, certainly because of, you know, I mean, and they were lucky. He was a high-profile guy, right? But what happens to everybody else you met on that floor? They go home to where, and then what? And their foundation, you know, has done great things in terms of answering that question. Then what? Trying to make a difference. So, you know, so God bless them.
60 million, I think, 60 million, right?
Right, something like that. And, you know, their partnership, if you go to their website, they partner with the NFL in terms of trying to make sure that money gets to the right places and things like that. So, no, an awesome story. And honestly, I mean, but for the grace of God, you know, Bob Woodruff dies that day. And so it's a very cool story, and well done, Mike. Well, for getting him on to come on, so that was cool.
I'll send him a text, and if you're listening to right now, Bob, I'm gonna call you.
Here's another email.
God, this Matt, is driving me crazy. Where did I?
Hold on.
I met Delora last year. That's what it was.
What?
I down here. I ran into Laura, the whole circle of stuff. I'll get it. I'll make some phone calls. I'll try and get her.
All right.
She's great. She's interesting.
Oh man. Yeah. Let me tell you, I mean, it's going to take a few sittings to listen to the whole thing because it is long. Right. But, her interview, she's a well thought, plain spoken, right? Paying attention to the truth. Reporter,
right?
The kind that the world needs more of. No, I don't say that because she doesn't lean either way. She just lets the truth rip, right? And her, when you hear her do analysis of an issue, whether it's Afghanistan or he asks her about Iraq, she does this very balanced, you know, this but not that, you know, and it's very impressive. Let me just read an email.
Okay,
Mac. The audio from Iwo Jima that you played in the first hour to start the program, thank you for doing that. That was awesome. I don't know that I've ever heard that audio anywhere else but on your show. Keep up the good work. I love Iwo Jima and the study of it, but hearing it, a guy doing play-by-play talking about his family and he hoped he would see him again was very cool this morning, along with the sounds of machine guns as they're going. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, don't touch the dial because the start of the show, I've been a fan of a student of the Battle of Iwo Jima. I've collected some incredible stuff and I play some of it. And it's one of the war correspondents in a landing craft heading towards the beach. Right, and he talks about being nervous. He talks about none of the guys want to talk to him about what they felt that morning. And they're headed for the beach. You hear the sound of the tractor. You hear all of that. And so, and then he talks about his family. He goes, I hope I get to see him again. So, and then you.
I have two bottles of sand.
And then you hear the machine gun, right? And honestly, it gives you chills. Because it's right? That moment in time, they're closing on the beach. And it's very cool. So yeah, 74 years ago today, Marines of the 4th and the 5th Division went ashore. Marines of the 3rd Division were told that, yeah, they'll take care of this. Probably not going to have to enter the fight.
Because it was such a small island. Could you imagine sitting up and looking at that? You're a battle-hardened veteran. You're like, that little thing? Shit. We'll be done with that thing by meal time.
Yeah.
By dinner.
Exactly. Exactly. So, it was, and we need to do, we should do a weapons thing about, we did this little thing about the Tony Stein's stinger that he made, but we should do something about weapons on Iwo Jima. I would enjoy
that. Okay.
Why don't you do a little bit of a deep dive and come up with what were
I already got it all right here. I already know them all.
Well, yeah, what were the weapons innovations that were introduced? Because as you go through the island hopping campaign of World War II, there were innovations one of those things. All right, so we'll do that.
What worked and what didn't work. Yeah,
right.
I know that.
All right, man. Thank you very much for the Woodruff thing. And
Let me get a hold of Laura. So
yeah, she's.
I didn't know, man. I completely blew that one. I knew she was a reporter, but I didn't know she. Okay.
Yeah, let me. I'll send you the links too. You'll love the interviews.
Okay.
All right. See you.
Talk to her.
There you have it, Michael Musselman, the one and only. He's Mike knows everybody. Shocker, right? Chatty Cathy. That he is, man. All right, whatever you do, don't touch that dial. In the first hour, you're going to hear a little bit of a tribute to the Marines, the sailors, and even the soldiers that went ashore later to start the show. And then we kind of transition pretty quickly to an excerpt from an interview. You'll find the full interview in the post the post on the website. So the interview was done by Mike Ritlin, former Navy SEAL, does a podcast thing, and she sits down with him for 3 hours and 39 minutes. And 37 seconds. How about that? And it's a great interview. Ohio man, who's a bit of a consumer of history and things intellectual and whatnot, but he's a conservative. He told me that he was most of the way through it, and it was awesome. So I would fully recommend it to you. You'll hear about 40 minutes of that interview. She starts by talking about Iraq. And her thoughts on the war. Not only our entrance to it, but the way Barack Obama took us out of it. Yeah, yesterday, you had people like putting Barack Obama. Like, what did Barack Obama do as a president that was great? He fucked up Iraq and he fucked up Afghanistan. I mean, look, socially conscious, yeah, okay. But yesterday, you pull these lists up? It's a joke. Those lists are stupid, by the way. When you have every recent president inside the top 20, except George Bush, right? I don't know if you could be a worse president than George Bush was. Seriously. I say that with all restraint. Look what George Bush gave the world. Right? Condoleezza Rice. Colin Powell. Dick Cheney played for the Celtics. Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, all the neocon idiots. Look what they unleashed on the planet. Fucking idiots. Yeah, that's why George Bush should shut his mouth, right? Shut his mouth. Do what you do in Texas. Don't ever comment on a public policy issue again. You fucked it up so bad. Like, yeah, how could you be a worse president? And what has an American president ever done that's worse and caused more loss of life unnecessarily than what those idiots did in the Bush administration? It's good. You know what? That's a good historical question. So when you look at the bottom five presidents, a list I saw had Bush at 5. He should be 1. Like, what other stupid transgression would get a president close to him in terms of number of people killed by what he's unleashed? What, Millard Fillmore because he sucked? Right? Andrew Johnson because he got impeached? I don't know. So, anyway, didn't mean to go off like that, but I kind of enjoyed it. All right. Don't touch that dial. Good stuff coming up next. Have a great day. President's Day in the rearview mirror. The Iwo Jima, the signature fight in Marine Corps history, where they raised both flags, not just one, and where 20,000 Japanese underground fought 40,000 Americans on top of the island. Have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio is over and...